So turn again then, please, to the book of Ruth, and our passage this evening is the one we read, Ruth chapter 3, verses 6 to 18. I'd like us to look at this passage this evening under two headings. And first of all then, a flowering romance. A flowering romance. And I mean, of course, the romance then between these two individuals, Ruth and Boaz. The book records two encounters between these two individuals. The first is a daytime encounter in the harvest field, and that's recorded in chapter 2. And the second is a nighttime encounter at the threshing floor. And that's the one recorded in our passage here in chapter 3. And the first there in chapter 2 certainly has its romantic touches, and we tried to bring that out when we looked at it a few weeks ago. But in this second encounter now, romance is a dominant and an overwhelming motif. And let's just remind ourselves then why this encounter is happening. Why this nighttime encounter at the threshing floor? Well, remember, it's Naomi's idea. It's her scheme. She has proposed it to Ruth there in the first part of the chapter. And remember, crucially, this is not about seduction. Remember, we said last time that is a charge so commonly laid at Naomi's feet, that this is a reckless and even a morally dubious proposal. But this is not about seduction. This is about, for one thing, Ruth and Boaz being able to have the privacy to talk properly. Privacy which probably was rarely afforded to them in the hustle and bustle of the harvest field day by day. And it's also then about Ruth indicating, I think, to Boaz her availability now for marriage. I said last time, it seems likely that up until now, Ruth had still been in her official mourning period, mourning her late Moabite husband. And probably been wearing some kind of garb which indicated she was a mourning woman. And so Naomi is telling her then to change now before she goes to the threshing floor. Get out of your mourning garb and wash yourself and anoint yourself and put on normal clothes. And so indicate to Boaz that you are available for marriage. And so as we watch then this encounter unfold here in our passage this evening, as we watch this romance flower, let's make Boaz the focal point and just notice a few things. First of all, Boaz's instincts. Boaz's instincts. So here he is then, and he's unaware, of course, that on this evening, his activities on the threshing floor are being watched. Someone is observing him. And he has his evening meal, we're told there in verse 7, at the end of which he settles down for the night. And he's had a busy day, no doubt, a day of hard physical labor. He's perhaps drunk good wine with his meal. And despite then the unforgiving nature of the surface he's lying on, I guess you would expect him to sleep fairly deeply and uninterruptedly throughout the night. But something, we're told in verse 8, something causes him to stir in the middle of the night. The ESV says that he was startled. But there's no real reason to think that anything startled Boaz. I suppose perhaps the supposition behind that is that perhaps it was Ruth's presence that startled him, but Ruth, I should imagine, was lying as still as she possibly could. And really, the Hebrew word, it means literally shake. Boaz, he shook or trembled. It's probably a shiver, I should imagine, that is here being referred to. And it's easy to see why Boaz would shiver. His feet have been uncovered. I guess that was probably Naomi's plan all along when she told Ruth to do that, to go and uncover his feet. After all, this conversation, it had to be in the middle of the night. Ruth couldn't kind of pounce on Boaz as he was finishing his meal and as he was settling down and converse with him then, because it's almost certain there would have been other men also present. And as I said a moment ago, privacy was the name of the game here. They wanted privacy to talk. And so the conversation had to be later on when everyone else was asleep, but it wouldn't be very dignified for Ruth to go and kind of shake Boaz awake in the middle of the night. And so this was probably Naomi's plan, just go and uncover his feet. And in due course, the chill of the night air will do its stuff, and he'll shiver, he'll wake up. And so it proves. And then we're told in the ESV here that he turned at that point. But again, that's not perhaps the best translation there. The only other time the word is used in the Old Testament is of Samson reaching out for the pillars in Dagon's temple. So perhaps something more like groped is the meaning of the word. And probably then he's kind of just sleepily kind of fumbling, groping for the bit of blanket he knows is not where it should be, covering his foot. It's something like that. And as then he kind of sleepily gropes for the blanket, his hand touches an object that he's not expecting to be there. And so at that point he just starts to wake up a little bit more. And he lifts his head then to see what this object is that his hand has just come against. And of all things, what he finds is a woman lying at his feet. Now think about it. Here's Boaz then, and it's the middle of the night. There's nobody else around that's awake, we must assume. There's this woman here now. She's probably fairly young. We've seen before, I think there are one or two indications in the book, she's an attractive woman. She's foreign, which means that she doesn't have rights, particularly. That were Boaz to molest her, he would probably get away with that without any charges being brought against him. He's living in a culture where men do use women for their own pleasure. Hence Naomi's words in chapter 2, verse 22. Don't go into anyone else's fields, otherwise you'll be assaulted. That was the culture, the climate of Bethlehem, the climate of Israel generally during the period of the judges. And this then is a massive test of Boaz's character. You know, there's those interesting words that Paul uses in 1 Corinthians 10, verse 13. He says this to the Corinthians. He says, "No temptation has overtaken you." That's the word the ESV has. Seized, the NIV has, which is perhaps slightly better. "No temptation has seized you," he says to the Corinthians. He's talking about idolatry and sexual immorality that some of those Corinthians are practicing. And his point is that it's not as though you Corinthians are kind of just innocently going about your daily business and temptation has come along from nowhere and waylaid you and seized you and overtaken you. No, he's saying, you Corinthians, you've gone looking for temptation. You've been visiting the pagan temples in the city where you know idolatry and sexual immorality goes on. You've gone out of your way to look for this temptation. It hasn't come along and overtaken you. It hasn't come out of nowhere and seized you. You've gone looking for it. But that wasn't the case with Boaz here, was it? Boaz hadn't gone looking for any temptation this night. Boaz was just going about his business innocently, just sleeping on the threshing floor that night, and temptation comes. In that situation then, Boaz can't work through some process to deal with the temptation. He can't work on cutting the supply lines by which the temptation has come at him. We all need to do that, don't we? We know that there are certain angles from which temptation comes at us, and we need to work at cutting the supply lines sometimes. That's what really what Jesus is saying, isn't it? Cut out the eye, cut off the hand, and so on. But Boaz can't do that. This is way past that stage. The temptation's there. It's right in front of him. And all Boaz has there now are his instincts. Everything depends now on Boaz's reactions in the heat of the moment. Everything depends on his instincts as he's suddenly overtaken, in Paul's language, seized by temptation. And wonderfully then, Boaz's instincts are to respond with purity and integrity and with respect for this woman who has turned up like this. What about ours then? What about our instincts? When we haven't gone looking for temptation, we haven't gone looking for sexual temptation, but it's suddenly there, unsolicited, on our computer screen or whatever. We haven't sought the opportunity to steal, but the opportunity is suddenly just there, because there's nobody around and there's this money or this object that's kind of crying out, take me. We haven't encouraged this gossipy conversation as we're just hanging out with friends, but the gossipy conversation is suddenly there and the natural thing is just to join in with it. What are our instincts like when temptation seizes us, overtakes us, comes by surprise, comes unsought for? We need to be praying, don't we, that we might have Boaz's instincts in such moments. Praying and indeed cultivating those instincts so that they are there when they're needed. Boaz's instincts. Secondly, notice Boaz's role. Boaz's role. So understandably then, seeing this woman at his feet and it presumably being too dark to initially recognize her, he asks, "Who are you?" And there in verse 9 then, Ruth's initial words in answer to that question are perfectly straightforward. "I am Ruth, your servant." But then with her next utterance, she seems at first sight just to be spouting complete nonsense, doesn't she? I mean, is this just the nerves of the occasion getting the better of her? What's she talking about? Why is she suddenly talking about birds? Wings? What on earth is she going on about? Well, I want to put it to you then that this isn't, of course, nonsense that she's spouting. This is a marriage proposal. Ruth here is proposing marriage. Now we know, don't we, that marriage was the goal of Naomi's scheme all along. We talked about that last time. That was the purpose of Ruth going to visit Boaz this night. Now, whether Naomi actually intended Ruth to basically utter a marriage proposal, or whether she intended Ruth just to kind of leave that in Boaz's hands, it's not entirely clear, but certainly that's what Ruth does. She here is saying to Boaz, "Will you marry me?" That's how Boaz interprets her words, isn't it? If you look in verse 10 there, he comments on how she has not gone after young men, whether rich, whether poor or rich. And that word gone after there, it's a strong word which is generally used in marriage contexts in the Old Testament. So he's saying then, you have not sought to marry these other men in Bethlehem, and by implication then, you are now seeking to marry me. So Boaz interprets this as a marriage proposal. Which raises the question, then, why does she couch it in these terms? Why this ornithological reference? Why is she talking about birds? Well, of course, you can't miss the connection, can you, with an earlier text in the book, with Boaz's words back in chapter 2, verse 12. You remember Boaz's description there of Ruth's conversion, essentially. I'm using, I guess, language that would not have been used, perhaps, of that experience at that time. But that, as we saw many weeks ago now, that's what happens to Ruth on the road to Bethlehem in chapter 1. She is converted. There's a regeneration, what we were talking about this morning, going on in Ruth there. And Boaz's description of that then, there in chapter 2, verse 12, is of Ruth coming under the wings of Yahweh. It's a wonderful picture, isn't it? So in conversion then, Yahweh hadn't flirted with Ruth. He hadn't gone on a fling with Ruth. He hadn't played around with Ruth. But he had taken this woman under his wings and said to her, I am going to protect you, Ruth. I am going to nurture you, Ruth. I am going to cherish you, Ruth. I am going to never let you go, Ruth. That was the nature of Yahweh's covenant commitment to this woman at her conversion. And interestingly then, she seems to understand the role of her future husband to be a replica of that. She understands that it's the role of her future husband to relate to her in the way that Yahweh relates to his people. And she's right, is she not? Which, for all of us here this evening who are husbands, is a daunting reality, a challenging reality. That's a big ask, isn't it? That we are to love our wives with such covenantal, such steadfast, such loyal, such unfailing, such protective, such concerned love, that every day our wives are getting a clearer understanding of what Yahweh is like because of what they see in us. And they go to bed at night saying, wow, God is like that. God is like that man who has loved me so much today, but even better. He's like that times an infinite number. It's a great thing, as I say, when our wives get a clear understanding of what Yahweh is like because of us. And this isn't just applicable actually in marriage. I think it's applicable in the realm of friendships as well. I sometimes wonder, how is it that David speaks so often in his Psalms about the covenant love of Yahweh? Perhaps more than any other author, he speaks of Yahweh's loving kindness, his steadfast love. How did he have such a clear understanding of it? And I'm convinced part of the answer, at least to that question, is this. He had seen it modeled in his friend Jonathan. A man who, naturally speaking, would have been in line for the throne of Israel. He was the king's son. He was Saul's son. Yet a man who had made a covenant with David, you're going to be king. And a man who was so loyal to David that he never once even attempted to vie for the kingship of Israel. David had seen in Jonathan what the love of Yahweh is like. You know, Ruth may not have been able to say these words to any other man in Bethlehem. There might not have been another man in Bethlehem that Ruth could possibly have said to, "Will you take me under your wings? Will you love me like Yahweh loves me?" Because as we've seen, Bethlehem wasn't a town overly populated with godly people. But she could ask Boaz that. How did she know that Boaz was the kind of man who could be a godlike husband to her? I think the answer probably is that she'd seen Boaz in his other relationships. And that's an important point. How do you know that a man, whether a man can love you like God, whether a man can be a godlike husband as he's called to be? Look at his other relationships. Ruth had seen the way Boaz had entered the field at the start of chapter 2, seen how he related to his workers. "The Lord be with you." She'd seen that. Why indeed was Boaz lying on the floor at all this night? Naomi seemed to know that's where Boaz would be. Why was Boaz lying on the floor? Why wasn't he sleeping in a nice comfy bed at home? Well, the answer probably is for security reasons. He was looking after the grain. But why couldn't he get one of his little hirelings to do that job? Why was he, the boss, the landowner, doing it? The commentators puzzle over that. This was unprecedented. This was very unusual. I suspect probably the answer again is that Boaz wasn't a normal landowner. Boaz was a kind-hearted man, and he had men working for him who were married and had children, and so he sent them home at night, and he himself stayed on the threshing floor. And Ruth had seen all that, and she knew that this was a man who could be a godlike husband. It's a great thing for a Christian man to be a godlike husband. So Boaz's instincts and his role, but then thirdly, his criterion. So in verse 11 then, he accepts the marriage proposal, it seems. He says, "My daughter, I will do for you all that you ask." And then he says, "For all my fellow townsmen know that you are a ravishing beauty." Well, that's not what he says, is it? He says, "For all my fellow townsmen know that you are a worthy woman." And the word worthy then, it's a word that we have two other times in the Old Testament, both relating to the character of a woman, and they're both in Proverbs, and one was there in chapter 31, the excellent wife, I think it was in the ESV, but it's worthy, it's the same Hebrew word that we have here. And of course the worthiness then that's referring to is then described in great detail throughout that chapter, isn't it? It's about character worthiness. This worthy woman in Proverbs 31, she's hardworking and industrious, and she's kind to the poor and the needy. It's a character worthiness that is in view. And that then is what Boaz is identifying here in Ruth. And as I said, I think there are indications that Ruth was an attractive woman. As we saw in chapter 2, she seemed to have cast a certain spell on the foreman, the chief worker in Boaz's field. And then there's that reference here in our passage to the fact that she could have gone after all the young men in Bethlehem. She was very marriageable, it seems, to them. And Boaz then, I'm sure, wasn't oblivious to this, and was attracted to Ruth at that level. But that's not his criterion. That's not the thing he said, "Yes, I'll marry you because of that." No, he says, "Because of this, because you are worthy." Why? Why this criterion, not that one? Well, Proverbs 31 actually goes on to give the reason, doesn't it? Remember how the passage ends. Verse 30, "Charm is deceitful and beauty is vain." Now, that doesn't mean that beauty is irrelevant, that beauty is insignificant. It means beauty is fleeting, vain. It's literally vapor. It's the word we have in Ecclesiastes so often. Beauty is ephemeral. It's fleeting. And that contrasts then with what Peter talks about, doesn't it? In 1 Peter 3, the imperishable beauty, as he puts it, of the hidden person of the heart. So there's a beauty that's external and fleeting, and there's a beauty that's internal and imperishable. And that then is Boaz's criterion. Will he marry this woman? Yes, because she has that internal, imperishable beauty. If you're a man this evening and you're thinking about marriage, what is your criterion in a society that's obsessed with externality, with appearance, with looks? Emulate Boaz's criterion. But then fourthly, Boaz's priority. Boaz's priority. So he has then, within his grasp, as it were, this woman who is beautiful and who is worthy. What a lucky guy, you might say. And then, in verses 12 and 13, he seems to lose the plot. Because there he says, well, yes, actually, I would like to marry you, but there's someone else, and I might have to waive my rights and allow him to do it. And so here's Boaz then, and he is going to pursue a route which risks losing Ruth. He could have just run off with her there and then. They could have arranged a marriage for the next day. But no, Boaz wants to go down this route of checking this other potential redeemer, another relative of Elimelech, who is apparently more closely related to Elimelech than he is. Boaz is going to go down that route, even though it risks losing Ruth. Why? Why on earth is he doing that? Well, the answer is that Boaz's priority, even higher than marrying this beautiful and worthy woman, Boaz's priority is doing the right thing. Doing the right thing. And he's evidently convinced then that this other man is more eligible in the eyes of God's law to marry Ruth than he is. Now, I use the language of Boaz being evidently convinced. And I use that language because I think it's questionable, actually, whether that was the case, whether this other man was more eligible in the eyes of God's law. It's questionable, I think, whether Boaz would have been sinning, whether Boaz would have been breaking God's law if he had just said, forget that other guy, I'm going to marry Ruth. Perhaps the only possible basis for him thinking in that way was Leviticus 25. And in Leviticus 25, 48 and 49, we have a kinsman redeemer passage. And there it's a situation, if someone has been sold into slavery, then the kinsman redeemer should come along and redeem the person out of slavery. And it kind of gives a list of all the people who that could be, all the different types of relative that could be. And the list is phrased in such a way that the nearest relative is mentioned first and the furthest relative mentioned last. And it may be then that Boaz had taken a verse like that and thought, well, that is saying that the nearer relative has more right than the more distant relative. And as I'm more distant than this other guy, then he has more right than I do. But it's questionable interpretation. And Naomi certainly doesn't seem to have ever come across that, does she? Because she's never bothered going to this other guy. She's focused on Boaz. But that's how Boaz sees it. In Boaz's eyes, he would be doing something dubious if he just ignored this other man and just went ahead and married Ruth. And so this is his priority. His priority, even above marrying this wonderful woman, his priority is doing the right thing. And that's challenging, isn't it? It can be hard sometimes when romance is flowering. It can be hard sometimes in those circumstances to do the right thing. Some of you may have heard of J. Gresham Machen. He was one of the outstanding evangelical scholars of the 20th century, an American New Testament professor. And Gresham Machen remained single all his life. Nothing remarkable about that. But it's interesting when you read his biography, the biography by Ned Stonehouse of J. Gresham Machen, he casts some interesting lights on that. He writes this. He says, "There was, however, one real romance in Machen's life, though unhappily it was not destined to blossom into marriage. He identified the lady by name as a resident of Boston and as intelligent, beautiful, exquisite. He further stated that apparently they were utterly devoted to each other for a time, but that the devotion never developed into an engagement to be married because she was a Unitarian. She made a real effort to believe, but couldn't bring her mind and heart to the point where she could share his faith. There was a flowering romance, but there was also a verse in Scripture about marrying in the Lord. And so Machen made that his priority, doing the right thing. That can be hard, and that can be costly. And so that then is the flowering romance, and just a few instructive matters to consider regarding Boaz. But secondly, and much more briefly, a future ruler. A future ruler. We mustn't get so engrossed in this romance as to think then that this is the primary purpose of the book. It's just a romance between these two ancient individuals. Because of course that isn't the primary purpose of the book. The book, in the last analysis, isn't about Ruth getting a husband, as we've said so many times. It's about Naomi having a child. This Naomi, who in chapter 1, verse 5, is barren, has been stripped of husband and sons, and can't possibly, it would seem, have a child. But the significance then of Ruth getting a husband is as a means to that end. It's through Ruth getting a husband that Naomi, the barren woman, can actually have a child. And that announcement can be made in chapter 4, verse 17. A son has been born to Naomi. And actually the narrator doesn't allow us here in our passage to forget that is the main purpose of the story. There are at least two reminders. First of all, in verse 10, Boaz is referenced there to Naomi's kindness. Now, it seems a bit strange at first sight. I mean, does this man really have such a low view of himself that he's kind of saying, you know, well, it's very kind of you to want to marry me. You obviously feel sorry for me, and you've been very charitable and generous and kind, wanting to marry me. That's not the point. He's not talking about her kindness to him. He's talking about her kindness to her mother-in-law, Naomi, because he says this last kindness is greater than the first. Well, what was the first kindness? It was that which he acknowledged back in chapter 2, verse 11. All that you have done for your mother-in-law since the death of your husband has been fully told to me. The way you've been so concerned for her and looked after her so painstakingly, that was the first kindness. And that was toward Naomi, and presumably then this second kindness now, or this last kindness, is also Naomi-oriented. And so Boaz is saying, wow, Ruth. I don't think he's denying that Ruth genuinely wanted to marry him because she was attracted to him as well. But he's saying, wow, Ruth, you're still also thinking of your mother-in-law. You're still thinking of Naomi. Why? Why was it an act of kindness toward Naomi? Well, because by marrying Boaz, Ruth was bringing this possibility one step closer of Naomi having a child. If Ruth had just gone and married one of the other guys in Bethlehem who wasn't related, then she might have had a child, but it wouldn't have been Naomi's child. It had to be the child of a kinsman redeemer to be Naomi's child. And so Boaz. And then the other thing is interesting, isn't it? This emphasis on the gift at the end of the passage that Boaz gives to Ruth to take back to Naomi. It seems a bit of an anticlimax, doesn't it? Kind of descending from the sublime to the ridiculous. We've had this kind of very delicate and very atmospheric, romantic scene on the threshing floor, and then it ends with such a stress on barley. And, you know, Ruth goes back and reports the night's events to Naomi, and it seems that the kind of the climax of her report is, and look, he's given me all this barley. And you think, well, that's pretty insignificant compared to the fact that you're going to get married now. But the key, the explanation, is in the comment that Ruth relays from Boaz to Naomi, or from Boaz, there in verse 17. He had said, you must not go back empty-handed to your mother-in-law. That's not just a bit of diplomacy on his part, keeping the mother-in-law on side. This is surely another verbal connection, because it's actually, you must not go back empty to your mother-in-law. Empty-handed, the handed bit isn't there in the original. You mustn't go back empty. And empty, of course, is precisely the word Naomi had used to describe herself back in chapter 1, verse 21. The Lord has brought me back empty. Meaning what? Well, he's brought me back husbandless, yes, and childless. I have a family. I had two wonderful boys, but I've been brought back childless. I've been brought back empty. And here's Boaz now saying, take this barley and say to your mother-in-law that you're not going to be empty. Because of this night's developments, the possibility of you having a child, the prospect of you having a child, has become so much nearer. Indeed, it's one commentator even speculates that just the way that Ruth kind of turned up at Naomi's house carrying this grain in front of her in her shawl may even have had the appearance of being pregnant, a kind of little sign that Boaz was sending to Naomi, the child that you don't have and would so love, that child, hopefully, is soon going to happen. But why then, let's remind ourselves, why is the story about Naomi having a child? What's significant about that? Well, remember what we said, that it's in that way God is going to provide his people with a king. That's how the book of Ruth fits into the book, the Bible, Genesis to Revelation. The book is all about God saving a people for himself. If God is going to save a people for himself, there has to be a king. And this then is God providing a king for his people. But remember, we've also said that this book of Ruth is not only about the kind of the mechanics by which God was going to provide a king, but also we get little glimpses in the book through Boaz of what that king was going to look like. And when I say that king, I don't mean David, although he was the immediate king. He's the last word of the book of Ruth. But of course, I mean David's greater descendant, Jesus. We get little glimpses in the book of Ruth of what the king is going to look like. Remember, we talked about this a few weeks ago, and we said that Boaz is a reformer, and Jesus is going to be a reformer. And we said that Boaz is a protector, and Jesus was going to be a protector. And we said that Boaz is a benefactor, and Jesus was going to be a benefactor. And that Boaz was an intercessor, and Jesus was going to be an intercessor. And Boaz is a lover, and Jesus was going to be a lover. And I think our passage this evening enables us to add one more label, one more description to that list. Boaz is a redeemer, and the king who is going to come through Naomi, Jesus Christ, would be a redeemer. Those great words there in verse 12, I am a redeemer. He was going to reclaim and restore this family, Elimelech's family, from the mess that it had gotten itself into. And so King Jesus was going to reclaim and restore his people from the greater mess, the mess of sin that they were in. And just closing there, notice quickly two ways that Boaz goes about his redemptive mission. He does it righteously. We've already commented on this, that he's so intent on doing the right thing, isn't he? He will not redeem this family by taking shortcuts. He feels that there's a legal matter that must be seen to. And so he will see to that legal matter. There'll be no shortcuts. There'll be no cutting corners for Boaz. And so King Jesus will redeem his people righteously, won't he? He will do it through obeying the Father unto death. We think of him there in the desert, and Satan is tempting him. Satan is saying to him, look, you can have your reward, the reward the Father has promised you. You can have it. You can have the nations of the earth by just bowing down to me. You can bypass the cross. Just bow down to me. Simple as that. And you can have it all. So tempting. So inviting. Jesus, no. I must go via the cross. I must do this redeeming work of mine righteously. Boaz here. So easy for him just to have said, oh, let's just get married. Forget that other guy. We won't even mention it to him. He'll find out once we're married. He does it righteously. And in that, he pictures Jesus, the Redeemer, who will redeem us by obeying the law. But then also he does it resolutely. He does it resolutely. I love verse 18, the final verse of the passage. I think probably Naomi here can see, as she looks into the face of her daughter-in-law, she can see that perhaps the adrenaline, the high of the night before, is now beginning to dissipate somewhat. And yes, it was all very powerful and romantic there at the threshing floor. And here was Boaz committing himself, I will do this. I will do my redemptive work and I will marry you. And it was all very credible then. But now it's the cold light of day. And perhaps Ruth is just beginning to think a bit about this. Well, will Boaz really go ahead with this? Perhaps he'll get distracted by all his agricultural responsibilities and he'll not bother going and seeing this other man that he's got to go and see today. Or perhaps he'll just get cold feet about the whole thing. Perhaps it won't happen after all. And so you have then Naomi assuring Ruth there in verse 18 and saying to him then, the man will not rest but will settle, the ESV has it, literally just finish. He will finish the matter today. He'll be focused. He'll be unerring. He'll be resolute. He'll do it. Just wait. You'll see. And you jump forward 1,000 years or so. And you have another midnight scene, not this time on the threshing floor, but in an olive grove. And you have the redeeming King, Jesus Christ, committing himself to redeem his people. I will take this cup. But several hours later, the night gives way to the morning. A new day. And what a day it has to be if indeed he's going to redeem his people. What a daunting timetable. From being tried before Pilate, to being flogged, to being led along the way to the cross, carrying that cross with him, to be nailed to it, to being suspended there between earth and sky, to being mocked and scorned, to being ultimately forsaken by his own beloved Father. Surely at some point along that route, along that sequence, he's going to say, I can't do this. I'm the Son of God. Get me out of here. That's why it's so wonderful, isn't it? You come to 3 o'clock in the afternoon or just after, and he takes a drink to loosen his lips, enable himself to speak, and then he shouts, using Naomi's language, the very Greek word we have in Ruth 3, verse 18, it is finished. I've done it. I haven't rested until I finished the matter today. We have a resolute Redeemer who has done everything necessary. A greater than Boaz. What a king. Amen. Let's sing.